Good afternoon, this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Thirty-two national soccer teams, a month-long tournament with a projected global TV audience in the billions. The 2014 World Cup kicks off tomorrow in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Good afternoon, I'm Andy Wagner, in for Bonnie Berman today. She returns tomorrow. But today we're talking about football. Football, futebol, soccer. That Shakira song we played, Hips Don't Lie, was used for the opening ceremony of the 2006 World Cup in Germany. This year's extravaganza in Brazil will be the 20th World Cup. It's being played out in a region that is seen as having passionate, even fanatical support for both club team and national side. Suicides sometimes follow bad results. Two countries even went to war after rival fans rioted. And it's being played out in a country that for many defines, symbolizes even, soccer as an art form, the beautiful game. Brazil have won the World Cup a record 5 times. However, the lead-up to this World Cup has not been without some bad publicity. Protests erupted in Brazil last year over the amount of money being spent on hosting the event, coupled with reports of stadiums and infrastructure behind schedule. So, soccer, why is it such an important part of life in Latin America? And with the normally soccer-crazy Brazilians out on the streets protesting, what are the prospects for World Cup 2014? To help us, we have Joshua H. Nadel. He's the author of Football: Why Soccer Matters in Latin America, a book that explores how national identity, politics, and soccer are linked in South and Central America. He's Associate Professor of History and Associate Director of Global Studies Program at North Carolina Central University. Also, a bit later on, we'll be talking to a journalist in Brazil about the preparations and atmosphere there. But first, welcome to Topical Currents, Professor.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you along. Football: Why Soccer Matters in Latin America, a fascinating, thoughtful book that examines the passions and the origins, the rivalries and historical context of soccer in Latin America. What inspired you to write it?
Well, I think that, you know, for me, as a historian of Latin America, I'm always trying to get at sort of the day-to-day things that go on in people's lives that sort of empower them and impassion them. And it struck me that soccer is one of those very things in Latin America. It's crucially tied into sort of how people define who they are and how societies define who they are.
So would you give us a brief history of how soccer became the game we recognize today and how it got established in South America?
Sure. So the game, you know, the rules of the game are actually developed in England. It's sort of the birthplace of the modern game in 1863. But within 4 or 5 years, actually, the game is in South America. It arrives in Argentina first with British bankers and sort of Anglo-Argentines coming back from school and British teachers who are sort of there to in efforts to modernize the countries of Latin America, efforts sort of started by Latin American leaders themselves. And they brought the game with them, and it very quickly caught on first with the elites in Latin America who sort of affiliated with the British, and then in the streets as well. And it's really when it catches on with the popular classes that it becomes the sport that we think of today as sort of the national sport in much of the region.
And you made the case in the book about soccer in Latin America being an integral part of national identity. Can you explain why that is?
Sure. So the sport arrives at precisely the moment that sort of the idea of the modern nation state is coming in, right? So as Latin America sort of becomes modern, soccer is there sort of at the birth of that modernity. So for instance, in Argentina, it's really used as the sport is used as a way to integrate new immigrants from Southern Europe, from Spain and Italy. In Brazil, it's used as a way to integrate both immigrants from Portugal and Italy, but also the African population or African descended population in Brazil that had been there since slavery and since colonial times. So it really sort of it embeds itself very much in these stories about who is part of the nation and how they become part of the nation.
And the perception of soccer fans in Central and South America, as compared to fans elsewhere in the world, you make a compelling case for that in the book.
That fans are more passionate.
The perception that they are more passionate and that more more fanatical in some ways.
Yes, I mean, I think that to a certain extent, it's true that they are. You know, that soccer is more an issue of national pride, perhaps, in a more palpable way than it is in Europe or certainly in the United States. But I think that sometimes that case gets overdrawn. I mean, I think that, you know, in Germany and England and Spain, people are equally fanatical about their teams as they are in Latin America. It's just that sometimes the way we describe people from Latin America tends to essentialize sort of passion. And so it's an easy way to essentialize this sort of Latin passion by saying, well, they're very passionate about soccer.
Right, because we see fans cry, games in Europe crying if their team loses or an important if they get
exactly.
relegated or whatever. Yes,
exactly, and certainly violent. You know, if we look at fan violence in Europe is equally as problematic, if not more so at this point than in Latin America.
Okay, let's turn to first of all, this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. I'm Andy Wagner, sitting in today for Bonnie Berman. We're talking to Joshua H. Nadell about his book, Football, Why Soccer Matters in Latin America. Let's turn to the concept of soccer as nationalism, as used by populist mm-hmm. leaders, and it's used to help legitimize regimes in Central and South America.
Sure.
No, go ahead, please.
In much of the region, depending on where you start, you can start. We might as well start in Brazil. In 1930, there's a coup that brings Getúlio Vargas to power, and he instantly sort of starts looking for homegrown elements of Brazilian culture that he could highlight in order to create sort of nationalist sentiment. So he actually looks at capoeira, which is the Afro-Brazilian martial art. He looks at samba, and he also looks to soccer as a way to sort of create a form of national unity around his new state. It is literally actually called the Estado Novo, the new state. And so during the 1938 World Cup, for example, when Brazil sends a team to France that finishes third, it's sort of one of the first times that Brazil shows itself to be a sort of an up-and-coming soccer power in the world. He's done a good bit of legwork to make it the national sport by distributing radios around the country and making sure that the games are broadcast to the extent possible sort of throughout Brazil or throughout the area of Brazil that has radio networks. If you move to Argentina in 1978, in the middle of the dirty war in Argentina, the military government had come to power a couple years earlier, and the World Cup was hosted in Argentina, and it was really used as a way to legitimize the regime, a way for the regime to show itself on the world stage as being, you know, as sort of saying, look, everything is fine in Argentina. There's nothing to worry about. All these reports about human rights abuses, et cetera, are sort of fallacies. So these are some of the ways that it's used by national elites to try to create a sense of unity or create some form of national sentiment in favor of the government.
Right. And I recall hearing an interview with an Argentine who was held in the Navy Mechanics School in 1978,
yeah.
whilst under interrogation, could hear cheers from the National Stadium. The River Plate Stadium is just a block or so away.
Yeah. And in fact, I mean, there are stories that after the match, I don't know if these are apocryphal or not, but mm-hmm. the regime took prisoners from the mechanic school and drove them around the streets of Buenos Aires in order to sort of break their spirit and say, look, nobody cares about you. Everybody is celebrating. Celebrating our... Exactly, yes. Exactly.
And that brings on to Chile in 1973, the use of the national football stadiums in that country after the Pinochet coup. Could you tell us, could you give us a lead up to that?
Sure. And I think Chile actually, you know, Chile... I talk about in the book as sort of both efforts to shore up the dictatorship and efforts to bring down the dictatorship. So in 1973, right after the coup, actually the Chilean national team was supposed to be flying to the Soviet Union on the day of the coup in order to play a playoff match to qualify for the World Cup. And of course, the coup happened that day. No flights went out. The Chilean national team flight actually left about a week later, and it was the first civilian flight to leave Chile after the coup. At first, Pinochet wasn't going to let the team travel. He was convinced that this would be a good PR move to let them go, and so they did. They traveled to the Soviet Union. They played a nil-nil draw, And then the Soviet Union refused to play it was a home and away series, and the Soviet Union refused to play the return match, citing the fact that the national stadium was being used as a concentration camp. And in fact, it was being used as a concentration camp. Mm-hmm. The FIFA had sent a delegation to make sure that everything was fine in the stadium, and what the Chilean Federation and the military government did is move the prisoners to certain locker rooms in the stadium. They showed them the field. The field was in perfect condition. They showed them the locker rooms. The locker rooms were fine, the team locker rooms, but they wouldn't let them see sort of the auxiliary rooms in the stadium because they were packed with political prisoners who were being tortured and murdered, following the September 11th coup. What's interesting about the Chilean case, or one of the things that's interesting about the Chilean case, first let me back up and say, so the Soviet Union refused to play the match, and so Chile actually went through to the World Cup on forfeit, and I'm pretty sure it's the first time that a nation has ever boycotted a World Cup qualifying event of that nature. But what's interesting about it is that then the 74 World Cup in West Germany is actually used as a venue for international solidarity groups to protest the military government. So whenever Chile played, there were protest flags in the stands. There were chants that could be heard on the audio feed back to Chile of Chile sí, junta no, Chile yes, military government no. And so it becomes sort of this site of protest in some ways. And it continues to be so in Chile. In the 1980s, some of the first protests against the Pinochet government happen in football stadiums. And then the star striker of the Chilean national team is very vocal, a very vocal opponent of Pinochet, and is in advertisements that play a big part in bringing him down in 1989.
We're speaking with Joshua Nadal, Associate Professor and Associate Director of Global Studies Program and Associate Professor of History at North Carolina Central University. Thank you, Joshua Nadal. It's time to take a quick break here on Topical Currents. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned. Well, we are in Miami after all. This is Ricky Martin, of course, from the 1998 World Cup. Good afternoon. I'm Andy Wagner with Joshua H. Nadal. He's Associate Professor of History and Associate Director of the Global Studies Program at North Carolina Central University. We're talking to him about his book, Football, Why Soccer Matters in Latin America. Well, let's move away from some of the more unfortunate and unsavory aspects of the game. Let's look maybe to the future. And let's look at women's soccer in the region, despite some social stigma and being held back initially. How is women's soccer doing in the region as a whole?
I think, that's a great question. I think women's soccer is actually gaining quite a bit of strength in the region. As you mentioned, it was... It was held back for quite some time, not only by social stigma, but by laws in Brazil, certainly. The women's soccer was made illegal in 1941, a ban that lasted into the mid-70s. But in general, women's soccer has been gaining some strength in the region. Both Brazil, which has been sort of a world power in the sport, basically by dint of the skill of their players, not so much because of the commitment of the soccer federation by any stretch of the imagination, but also in countries like Mexico and Colombia and Chile, you're beginning to see sort of the growth of women's soccer in a really sort of sustained and organized way. It was, at one point stigmatized because it was thought to cause infertility and it was thought to cause potentially cancer. And it was thought to be quote-unquote masculinizing. And so really Latin American parents didn't want their daughters to be playing for these reasons. But those attitudes have really been changing, I would say, over the last 5 to 10 years. It still has a long way to go in terms of those attitudes, but it is definitely getting better.
If there was a country that would break out, as the sport got more popular here in the USA in the late 90s, who would you point to? Which country do you think would...
Well, so I mean, if the Brazilian Federation were to put the funds in that they should, I would say Brazil would easily be the breakout. I mean, they've already won silver medals in the Olympics, and they've been very close to sort of winning gold and winning the Women's World Cup. But there's been sort of a step back. The last Women's World Cup in Germany, Brazil showed up for the tournament, I think, less than 5 days before the tournament with sort of insufficient practice time. And they actually were wearing sort of modified versions of the men's uniforms. If you look at the Brazilian crest for the men's uniforms, has five stars on it to signify that they've won the World Cup five times. The Brazilian women were actually wearing men's jerseys, which represents a major step backwards. Otherwise, I would say, you know, the two teams that have made major steps forward are Mexico and Colombia. Colombia went to its first Women's World Cup in 2011. It didn't do so well, but the fact that it's there and that funding from the Central Federation has continued is a great thing. I think Mexico also was in 2011. They qualified. They beat the United States during qualification, and that was obviously a major step since the U.S. is, you know, the world power or a world power. But also in Mexico, what's heartening is that there's increasingly sort of a nationwide network of women's soccer leagues and women's soccer teams and girls' soccer teams as well. So it's growing at a grassroots level, which is really what it needs. And then those grassroots teams are getting support from the Central Federation. And, you know, in the past in Mexico, women have played for a long time. Mexico actually hosted the second unofficial Women's World Cup in 1971, but the Federation has never supported them. So the grassroots have basically survived for 30 or 40 years on sort of, you know, word of mouth and volunteer support.
Interesting. Well, let's move on to Brazil now. It's the only team to play in every World Cup. Five-time champions. Can you take us through the early development of the national side? First of all, how did soccer arrive in Brazil in particular?
Sure. Brazil, much like the rest of the region, Brazil, it comes, you know, with Englishmen or Scotsmen, depending on where in the country. But the sort of the father of the sport, the person who's considered the father of the sport is this guy named Charles Miller, who returns to Brazil after 10 years in boarding school in England. He was born in Brazil from a Scottish father and an Anglo-Brazilian mother. And he returns to school to Brazil in 1894. And with him, he brings the rule book. He brings a couple balls. He brings shoes. And he sort of initiates play at the Sao Paulo Athletic Club, which is a very elite athletic club in Brazil. And from there, again, sort of people see the game. You know, poor youth on the street watch the elite, you know, behind their fences, and they say, "Huh, I think we could do that as well." And so they begin to play. And by the early 1900s, really the sport is already sort of the dominant sport in the country. What's different about Brazil from the rest of the region in many ways is that sort of in much of Latin America you have this sort of the idea that there's a sort of two points of birth, if you will, birthplaces or birth times of soccer, right? So it's when it arrives with the foreigners, and then when the young youth, local youth, can defeat the international players, the expatriates. In Brazil, there's this sort of third birth, which is when Afro-Brazilians enter the field in large numbers, and that really starts to happen in the 1920s. The first Afro-Brazilian club, or first mixed race club, to win the Sao Paulo championship, the Rio championship, is Vasco da Gama, they win the championship in 1923, and in 1924 the league changes rules so that Vasco da Gama can't play because they don't want to have Brazilians of mixed race or of African heritage playing against the elites. That all sort of starts to change in 1938. Sort of, I mentioned before, when Brazil goes to France in 1938, they bring a team with a couple Afro-Brazilian players, including Leonidas da Silva, who's nicknamed the Black Diamond, and he's the leading scorer in the tournament. He's sort of an epiphany to the world about Brazilian style, and this is really when the idea of the beautiful game is born in the 1938 World Cup, and that that sort of shifts the discourse a lot in Brazil, not only in terms of soccer, but in terms of the national discourse of including people of African descent into sort of conceptions of citizenship and conceptions of the nation, you know, that Brazil's African heritage actually matters. Leonidas da Silva and the soccer team actually play a crucial role in creating that shift in Brazil.
And but there was a slight change of opinion, I believe, after 1950, was there not? When there was a...
Yes, definitely. Yeah, sorry, definitely. The 1950, you know, while 38 sort of brings people of African descent into the discussion, it's not really until 1958 that place is cemented, and that's largely because of 1950 and 1954. In 1950, of course, the last time Brazil hosted the World Cup, you had the famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, Maracanazo, right? When Uruguay defeats Brazil in the finals in the Maracana in 1950. And there are two players who get blamed for that defeat. One is the goaltender, Moacir Barbosa, and the other is João Ferreira, the left back. And they're both of African descent. And they both, basically, the loss was blamed on the fact that Brazilians of African descent weren't advanced enough in terms of civilization. They were passive in the face of white players, and they were weaker generally, both sort of physically and emotionally weaker. So this really sort of sets back the discourse on race a lot, and that is actually furthered by 1954, when again Brazil loses in the quarterfinals, this time to Hungary, and the head of the Brazilian Federation in 1954 actually explicitly blames the loss on the fact that Brazil was a black team and the European teams were white and more advanced, more civilized, more rational. So for this sort of, you know, 20-year period between 38 and 58, there's really a good deal of debate about whether the beautiful game and whether sort of the African influence on Brazil soccer and in Brazil society is something that should be you know, applauded or sort of avoided. And of course, 1958 with Pelé and Garrincha and Nilton Santos, the team that wins the World Cup for Brazil for the first time, sort of once again shifts the discourse back towards, you know, an affirmation of blackness in Brazil and also in Brazilian soccer.
And how do attitudes in the public and in the media towards the makeup of the national side compare to these days?
You know, the makeup of the national side then and now, I think that there's,
I mean, is it even an issue anymore?
Yeah, I was going to say it's not really an issue anymore, right? I think the only place where it was recently an issue was when Dunga was the former captain of the Brazilian national team and the coach from 2006 to 2010. It became something of an issue just because of the style of soccer that he played.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yes. The Dunga years.
The Dunga era, which, you know, Dunga was a phenomenally successful coach. You know, I believe Brazil won something like 40 matches, lost 6, and tied 11 while he was coach. So it's, you know, by any objective measure, that's a good record. But he played a style, it's called Futebol Força, sort of, you know, strong football or brute football, if you will, that Brazilians, you know, said, well, this is not our game. We play the Jogo Bonito. We play the beautiful game. We don't like this. And the Futebol Força is somewhat associated with the military regime from in the 60s and 70s into the 80s, and somewhat also associated with sort of, you know, European Brazil from the south. So that's the only time that gets brought up. But generally speaking, people don't bat an eyelash at the racial makeup of the team anymore, right? It's expected that it's going to be a mixed race team, I think.
We're talking to Joshua Nadal. He is Associate Professor of History and Associate Director of the Global Studies Program at North Carolina Central University. His book, Football, Why Soccer Matters in Latin America, is a fascinating read. The referee, however, has blown the whistle for halftime. When we return to kick off the second half, and I can't go with these cheesy jokes, we'll be talking to journalist Kayvon Haidari, who's in Rio de Janeiro and is covering this World Cup. Can you stick around for the rest of our show, Professor?
I definitely will, yeah.
Thank you very much. Great, we'll be back after this break. This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN.
Paulo César. Recebeu o ponteiro, caminhou outra vez, adução na entrada da área perigosa. Passou pelo Bob Moura, entrou na área, bateu o Raiz, correu, cruzou para Pelé, ajeitou para Jair, vai marcar, atirou gol!
Welcome back to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Andy Wagner here, sitting in for Bonnie Berman. Don't worry, natural order of things will resume tomorrow, but today it's all things World Cup soccer. With me is Joshua H. Nadell, Associate Professor of History and Associate Director of the Global Studies Program at North Carolina Central University. We've been discussing his book, Football, Why Soccer Matters in Latin America. We're also talking about Brazil 2014, which kicks off tomorrow in Sao Paulo. Brazil, famously often seen as the hotbed of football, as art, with a countrywide enthusiasm for the beautiful game, but this time around, maybe not so much. A Pew Research Center study, taken in April and released last week, shows 6 Brazilians in 10, around 61%, think hosting the World Cup is a bad thing, taking money away from education, health, and other public services. The survey points to skepticism over the perceived international benefit of having the World Cup in Brazil, and overall 72% of Brazilians are dissatisfied with the economy in general. With the estimated costs between $11 and $14 billion, it's the most expensive World Cup so far. To tell us more about the mood in Brazil, we go to Rio de Janeiro and Kayvon Antonio Haidari, an international journalist specializing in reporting on football and soccer. He's worked for NPR, the Miami Herald, El Nuevo Herald, and Telemundo, among others. Thank you for joining us, Kayvon. How many World Cups is this that you've covered now?
Well, thank you for the invitation. This will be my 8th World Cup. This one, I don't have a credential, but I think in the 7 World Cups I've done before, I've seen a transformation from what is really a wonderfully charming event to now just a corporate behemoth that is not as attractive to me, but still I love seeing the people and how they process the World Cup. And I think the one main difference is that you see the people excited about it, except the Brazilians are not.
Right. That's the impression we're getting. What is the atmosphere there in Rio like?
Well, the atmosphere in Rio is a little bit tepid, really, mostly because, you know, you have the fans coming in to watch the teams, but the tournament starts in Sao Paulo. I was in Belo Horizonte, which is where Colombia will have its first match, and the Colombians are quite excited about it. There's a lot of Americans. I don't know if you can hear me above the train, Ben, but there's a lot of Americans traveling, and Americans are now the second biggest travelers to the World Cup, the second biggest amount of tickets bought. A lot of them are expats that live in the United States, but they're excited. The Brazilians, however, are not. I ran into a couple with suitcases this morning, and I thought, oh, you're traveling in to the city for the tournament. He goes, no, we are, estamos fugindo da cidade, is what they said in Portuguese, which means we are escaping Rio to get out of this madness.
Right.
So there's some that, of course, the prices are going up. Rio was not an inexpensive city to begin with, but now you can factor that by 2 or 3. But, you know, it always, I think the trust is that Rio and Brazilians will catch the fever as the tournament progresses and their team does well.
Well, Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff went on television last night, Tuesday night, defending the World Cup choice and was calling on all Brazilians to back the team. Did you see the broadcast?
No, I mean, you know, she will take the company line. Basically, we decided to spend this money on the World Cup instead of schools, education, hospitals, and now we're on the train. We might as well wait till it plays out. Pele also said, you know, please, yeah, we understand, but please don't be against the cup. And so these are establishment voices. Really, there's a lot of anger. There's a lot of anger, and I don't know what will happen once Brazil loses. And last year in the Confederations Cup, we were reading that, you know, it was on during the Confederations Cup, which is a sort of a warm-up tournament for the World Cup, that the FIFA almost suspended the Confederations Cup, which would have meant, in the utmost, taking the World Cup from Brazil. But the Minister of Sport was able to handle the situation. It continued. But there's something, I don't know if you've heard of the Black Blocs, which are getting organized to create a bit of havoc.
And on that subject...
And if you...
Go on, Kayvon.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead, Kayvon.
No, and if you want a big platform for your message, it certainly can't get much bigger than the Olympics and the World Cup.
Right, I was going to ask you...
So we'll find out what they will do.
Right, so there's still a threat of disruption to the games themselves in the days ahead, as far as you know.
Well, there's general discontent. What happens is when does the discontent of many join with the anger of a few into a dangerous combustion, and it catches fire at some point, somewhere, in Sao Paulo, Rio, wherever there's a large population that feels that its social services are being neglected on behalf of bread and circuses.
Right. Well put. And this is a question for both you, Kayvon, and for Professor Nadal, if you have a sense of it. Obviously, dissatisfaction against the Brazilian government and the economy, but how does the average man or woman in the street feel about FIFA, the international football's governing body?
Let me see if I understood correctly. How does the average person on the street feel about FIFA?
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's the deal, Andy, and I don't know if Joshua is there on the line, but FIFA basically is an organization that dictates from above in order to control the chaos that is all the organizations and all the cultures that make up world soccer. So from Zurich, they say, okay, you want the World Cup? Here's how it works. You have our party. You pay for it. We leave. We put our name on it. We leave. You clean up. You pay for it.
Right.
And a lot of people don't like that. And they don't accept any sort of governmental oversight. They don't respond to anybody. It's a completely non-transparent organization. You don't know who voted for whom, for the FIFA president. Everything is done behind closed doors. And, you know, they don't own the game. They may own the World Cup, but a lot of people feel they don't own the game. And there was a lot, and there's a lot that happens outside of the World Cup. And the game is really about kids playing on the street with no shoes, no ball, no field. Just whatever it takes around the world, that's what the game is about. And there's leagues and there's so many other things. And a lot of people feel that they've appropriated the event. Now, have they done a good job of marketing it? Yes. Have they done a good job of broadcasting it? Yes. A lot of this is a bit of corporate administration, you know? But they answer to no one. They heed no government. And they're completely opaque, and there's no transparency. And most people feel that they're completely corrupt. Other than that, they like FIFA. So, I don't know what to say.
I would only add to that that many of the protests are around the idea, or they're galvanized around the idea that, you know, FIFA demands certain quality of resources, right? A certain quality hotel, a certain quality air infrastructure, a certain quality wireless link, for example, certain quality restaurants. And so the protests have sort of taken that and run with it to a large extent, right? Saying, you know, we want FIFA quality hospitals, we want FIFA quality schools instead of FIFA quality stadiums. That, you know, part of the reason that there's so much anger is that, you know, that originally there was going to be no tax dollars paid to go into stadiums. It was originally estimated about $1 billion of stadium expenses that would all come from private sources. In the end, it's over $3 billion on the stadiums alone, and it's almost all coming from tax sources, which will then go back to, after the tax dollars are used to fix up stadiums, the stadiums then revert to their private owners after the World Cup. So there's a good deal of anger at FIFA around that. I think it's also instructive, just one last thing on this, is that, you know, Jerome Valcke, the second in charge of FIFA, in April of last year, sort of at a meeting in Zurich, said that he prefers working with less democratic governments because it's much easier for FIFA to get what they want and to do things their way. So Brazil has been... For FIFA, it's been really difficult to work with Brazil because it is this sort of chaotic democracy.
Yeah. I don't know if you can hear me, but I think, Joshua, what you mentioned is quite right, and that's why they take authoritarian governments, and governments who've always wanted to legitimize their rule have always picked sports events. Take from the 1934 World Cup, Mussolini, 1936 Olympics in Berlin, and you can go on down the line. And governments that want to make a splash on the world stage will pick a world event. And as such, you're right about the authoritarian governments. All they need to do for next World Cup in Russia will be to just sort things out with the Russian government. But however, what we're getting is a divide in culture, because it's the European countries which control the players and the money in the game that are saying, hey, we want some transparency. And first in that line is the English. And they're saying, you know, they put a little bit of pressure on them, saying, you know, it's a corrupt organization. Look at this manifestation of this evidence of corruption. And FIFA reacts to that criticism, but they really don't change at its heart. And that's what people see, and you're right. They're asking for, quote-unquote, FIFA quality this, FIFA quality that, and most people will not be able to get in the games, and they'll be watching on television. But there's an interesting little anecdotal event here that is the people who have been displaced from their homes or have been evicted to upgrade, quote-unquote, either roads, stadiums, or something, they're holding a little mini World Cup here in one of the favelas, and I think that's an interesting event, because they say, okay, look, we're not part of that World Cup, but we'll do our own World Cup, so, and they're doing like a pickup game World Cup here in Rio. And I think those are some of the interesting side stories.
We're talking to Joshua Nadel and Kayvon Haidari here on 91.3 WLRN's Topical Currents. It's time for a water break, perhaps to quickly practice our penalty kicks, eh, England? We'll be back in a moment with more Topical Currents and discuss the prospects for the teams playing in this year's World Cup. Stay tuned.
A spayed or neutered pet may live a longer, healthier, and happier life and will not add to the pet overpopulation problem. During the month of June, the Humane Society of Greater Miami's clinics are offering very reduced prices on spay-neuter services. Info at humanesocietymiami.org from the WLRN Community Bulletin Board.
Para una domingo, para una domingo.
We are in stoppage time here on 91.3's Topical Currents, today dealing with soccer in Central and South America and the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, which kicks off tomorrow. Supposedly that song is maybe about Brazilian attacking midfielder, winger, forward, Garrincha, who helped Brazil win the World Cup in both 1958 and 1962. I, Andy Wagner, however, I've never won the World Cup, no matter what the voices in my head say. The other voices you've been hearing this hour, they belong to Kayvon Antonio Haidari, soccer journalist, author, and historian, who's in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro, right now, to cover the World Cup. Glad you're still on the line with us, Kayvon. And Professor Joshua H. Nadel. And Professor Joshua H. Nadel, yeah. Associate Professor of History and Associate Director of the Global Studies Program at North Carolina Central of University. He's the author of Football, Why Soccer Matters in Latin America. Now, Brazil may have home advantage to win the cup, but I would be... In fact, I've heard it said that it's Brazil's to lose and maybe Spain's to retain, but let's look at some of the other teams from the region who made it to this competition. Colombia, Uruguay, Argentina, Chile, Ecuador, Honduras, Mexico, let's not forget Los Ticos, Costa Rica, and of course Team USA, coach Jurgen Klinsmann at the helm, but veteran striker Landon Donovan cast overboard. Kayvon Haidari, what is the general assessment of the USA's lineup and their chances in this competition?
Thank you. And I think from what I heard is, what is the general assessment of the chances of each of those teams?
No, specifically of Team USA, of the American team.
Oh, Team USA has no chance, but the to win the cup. I've been watching some online surveys, and some Americans think USA has a chance. You can't win the cup unless you've made it to a couple of semifinals or quarterfinals or maybe a few finals. It's sort of an ingrained muscular memory in the DNA of the soccer-playing countries. The one good thing the United States has is the United States is about reinventing history in people's identity. And so maybe the American kids, if they had the players, could come in and just whiz through a tournament. But the United States is really lacking in terms of talent. And the one player which could decide matches in previous World Cups, Landon Donovan, was left off the team. I don't know what you think. This is the way I see it. I mean, there's a, what in Brazil is called a crack, a craque, which means the player with the skill and the invention and the play, let's say Lionel Messi or Andres Iniesta or something of the sort. And there have been teams which have surprised in the run through the tournament, take Cameroon 1990, maybe Denmark 1986. I don't know, take Senegal in 2002 and a few more, or Ghana. But at some point, the experience, the lack of experience, hits them in the face, and they run into one of the big boys, which are Italy, Germany, Brazil, Argentina, and now Spain, and they get knocked out of the tournament. Now, if I may say something, we've been following Spain as they travel for the last 2 years, and if I may I do a plug, I guess, we did a documentary on them, which is called On the Road to History. And if they win back-to-back, the Euros and the World Cups, my God, you know, then they'll have to be mentioned because it's very tough to maintain this level. There's a, I think there's a Twitter handle. It's called Sport360TV, where we show some of the videos we've done with them. I hope that's not too inelegant to mention it. At Sport360TV. And there's a YouTube channel, and it was set up. But we're trying to find those stories where you can get away from what is presented to you in a prepackaged tournament and show those human interest stories.
Right.
And I think that's why we come to the World Cup, because the World Cup is about each person's experience at the World Cup, not really just the big team.
Right. Well, speaking of not just the big teams, how about Chile and Colombia? They've both been mentioned as possible dark horses. How do you rate their chances?
I think
I wasn't sure. Was that question for all of us, for both of us?
It was Kayvon first, but if you want to jump in, Joshua, please do.
Sure. I would just say I think Colombia's chances took a huge hit when their sort of star striker Falcao was left off the squad because of a knee injury. You know, they still have, I think, a good amount of pace and some skilled players, but really their chances, I think, took a significant hit. I think they should probably still get out of the group phase, but they won't get much farther than that, just because they're not in a particularly difficult group. As far as Chile, you know, Chile has got a sort of very on-form striker in Arturo Vidal, and they've also got Alexis Sanchez. So I think that Chile could, you know, make some waves. Again, depending on how the chips fall, they should make it out of their group. They probably won't make it out of their group because they're with Spain and the Netherlands. But they have a slight chance. Let's put it that way.
And I have a question here from a certain Mrs. Andy Wagner. That's Costa Rica, a talented squad this time round, but they also drawn in a tough group with Italy, Uruguay, and England. What are their bets on?
I agree with Joshua. I think Chile could be a surprise, and I think in that group, I think it'll be Holland who will run out of steam and get knocked out ignominiously. I think because, you know, I think it's either Spain and Holland and Chile, and Chile will take one of those two, one of their spots in the second round. Chile has got a lot of support. There are a lot of Chileans here. Some of it has to do with the economic climate in Chile allows them to travel. And the Colombians, I think, even without Falcao, Joshua, you mentioned him, yeah, he's a big loss, but they have a load of talent that doesn't need Falcao, and I think that is a generational change. And, of course, they're also chastened by the experience of 94 where they got knocked out and they thought they were going to win the World Cup. But I think they will go through, to be honest with you. And I think the big surprise will be Italy. You know, I think watch out for them. So Italy always has one good World Cup, one bad one. One good one, one bad one. And they got knocked out first round last time. And France, same thing. One good one, one bad one. And I think they could make a splash, too. They have a pretty easy first round group. And the story of France is the story of modern European football, which is, and so is the story of Italy, which is that the immigrants are now filling in those teams and being the stars of those teams.
And do you think that continental advantage, the fact the cup's been played in South America? Do you think that will come to play? It has done historically.
Well, the reality is that most of the top-level players play in Europe the whole year. And for all of them, it's an adaptation to travel to South America. So I think that has been reduced. The last World Cup that was played in the summer, Southern Hemisphere, was South Africa, and Spain won it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there, if Brazil advances and Argentina advances or Chile advances or Colombia advances, it will be a huge advantage. But weather-wise, I don't think so. I don't know what you think, Josh and Andy.
I would agree. I would agree completely, actually, that I think the continental advantages are getting less and less, or is getting sort of weaker and weaker as players really are global, and as the sport globalizes. Not only are people sort of playing overseas, and that travel hurts, but they're also seeing the styles of play. I mean, back in the day when the World Cups would rotate between the Americas and Europe, you know, really that was, there were very few Latin American players playing overseas.
And very few advantages.
And now,
very few opportunities to see the game. Well, I'm afraid that's it, gentlemen.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm afraid that's it. The referee is looking at his watch. We have come to the end of the show. Thank you to journalist, broadcaster, author, historian Kevin Antonio Heydari. He's in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro, reporting on the World Cup. Kevin, where can our listeners read your reports?
I'm sorry?
Where can our listeners read
your reports? I'll be writing on a couple of websites. One of them is Voxy.com, V-O-X-X-I, and there's a couple coming up. We're still figuring out Terra.com. I have a column there, and the at Sport 360, it's a documentaries that we do, but it has a YouTube channel, at Sport 360 TV, I think it is, and that's the Twitter handle, and the people will point you to where those will be. And I may be doing some stuff for NPR also, but we're figuring out that right now.
Well, have a good World Cup and stay safe. Also, many thanks to Joshua H. Nadell for hanging with us for this program. He's author of Football, Why Soccer Matters in Latin America. Do you have a website, Joshua?
I do not have a website, but my Twitter handle is @JHNadel.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Well, that's it. Thank you for all our thank you for all producer Richard Ives for his help and support. Thank you to Bonnie Berman for having the idea of handing the reins off to me for this program. She won't make that mistake again. This is Andy Wagner. Stay tuned for Here and Now, which is coming up next from NPR News.